Spanish-American War, The Rough Riders in Tampa, by Theodore Roosevelt. The journey by rail from San Antonio to Tampa took just 4 days, and I doubt if anybody who was on the trip will soon forget it. Everywhere, the people came out to greet us and cheer us. They brought us flowers, they brought us watermelons and other fruits, and sometimes jugs and pails of milk, all of which we greatly appreciated. We were traveling through a region where practically all the older men had served in the Confederate Army, and where the younger men had all their lives long drunk in the endless tales told by their elders at home, and at the crossroads taverns and in the courthouse squares, about the cavalry of Forrest and Morgan and the infantry of Jackson and Hood. The blood of the old men stirred to the distant breath of battle. The blood of the young men leaped hot with eager desire to accompany us. The older women, who remembered the dreadful misery of war, the misery that presses its iron weight most heavily on the wives and the little ones, looked sadly at us. But the young girls drove down in bevies, arrayed in their finery, to wave flags in farewell to the troopers, and to beg cartridges and buttons as mementos. Everywhere we saw the Stars and Stripes, and everywhere we were told, half-laughing, by grizzled ex-Confederates, that they had never dreamed in the bygone days of bitterness to greet the old flag as they now were greeting it, and to send their sons, as now they were sending them, to fight and die under it. It was 4 days later that we disembarked in a perfect welter of confusion. Tampa lay in the pine-covered sand flats at the end of a one-track railroad, and everything connected with both military and railroad matters was in an almost inextricable tangle. There was no one to meet us or to tell us where we were to camp, and no one to issue us food for the first 24 hours. While the railroad people unloaded us wherever they pleased, or rather wherever the jam of all kinds of trains rendered it possible. We had to buy the men food out of our own pockets and to seize wagons in order to get our spare baggage taken to the camping ground, which we at last found had been allotted to us. Once on the ground, we speedily got order out of confusion. On the wood's eye, the tents were put up in long streets, the picket line of each troop stretching down its side of each street. The officers' quarters were at the upper ends of the streets, the company kitchens and sinks at the opposite ends. The camp was strictly policed and drill promptly begun. For 36 hours we let the horses rest, drilling on foot, and then began the mounted drill again. The regiments with which we were afterward to serve were camped near us, and the sandy streets of the little town were thronged with soldiers, almost all of them regulars, for there were but one or two volunteer organizations besides ourselves. The regulars wore the canonical dark blue of Uncle Sam. Our own men were clad in dusty brown blouses, trousers, and leggings being of the same hue, while the broad-brimmed soft hat was of dark gray, and very workmanlike they looked as. In column of fours, each troop trotted down its company street to form a squadron or battalion, the troopers sitting steadily in the saddles as they made their half-trained horses conform to the movement of the Giddens. Over in Tampa Town, the huge winter hotel was gay with general officers and their staffs, with women in pretty dresses, with newspaper correspondents by the score, with military attachés of foreign powers, and with onlookers of all sorts. But we spent very little time there. We worked with the utmost industry, special attention being given by each troop commander to skirmish drill in the woods. Once or twice we had mounted drill of the regiment as a whole. The military attachés came out to look on, English, German, Russian, French, and Japanese. With the Englishman Captain Arthur Lee, a capital fellow, we soon struck up an especially close friendship, and we saw much of him throughout the campaign. So we did of several of the newspaper correspondents, Richard Harding Davis, John Fox, Jr., Caspar, Whitney, and Frederick Remington. On Sunday, Chaplain Brown of Arizona held service, as he did almost every Sunday during the campaign. There were but 4 or 5 days at Tampa, however. We were notified that the expedition would start for destination unknown at once, and that we were to go with it, but that our horses were to be left behind, and only 8 troops of 70 men each taken. Our sorrow at leaving the horses was entirely outweighed by our joy at going, but it was very hard indeed to select the 4 troops that were to stay and the men who had to be left behind from each of the troops that went. Colonel Wood took Major Brody and myself to command the 2 squadrons, being allowed only 2 squadron commanders. The men who were left behind felt the most bitter heartburn. To the great bulk of them, I think, it will be a lifelong sorrow. I saw more than one, both among the officers and privates, burst into tears when he found he could not go. No outsider can appreciate the bitterness of the disappointment. Of course, really, those that stayed were entitled to precisely as much honor as those that went. Each man was doing his duty, and much the hardest and most disagreeable duty was to stay. Credit should go with the performance of duty and not with what is often the accident of glory. All this and much more we explained, but our explanations could not alter the fact that some had to be chosen and some had to be left. One of the captains chosen was Captain Maximilian Luna, who commanded Troop F from New Mexico. The captain's people had been on the banks of the Rio Grande before my forefathers came to the mouth of the Hudson, or Woods landed at Plymouth. And he made the plea that it was his right to go as a representative of his race, for he was the only man of pure Spanish blood who bore a commission in the army, and he demanded the privilege of proving that his people were precisely as loyal Americans as any others. I was glad when it was decided to take him. It was the evening of June 7th when we suddenly received orders that the expedition was to start from Port Tampa, 9 miles distant by rail, at daybreak the following morning, and that if we were not aboard our transport by that time, we could not go. We had no intention of getting left, and prepared at once for the scramble which was evidently about to take place. As the number and capacity of the transports were known, or ought to have been known, and as the number and size of the regiments to go were also known, the task of allotting each regiment or fraction of a regiment to its proper transport, and arranging that the regiments and the transports should meet in due order on the dock, ought not to have been difficult. However, no arrangements were made in advance, and we were allowed to shove and hustle for ourselves as best we could, on much the same principles that had governed our preparations hitherto. We were ordered to be at a certain track with all our baggage at midnight, there to take a train for Port Tampa. At the appointed time, we turned up, but the train did not. The men slept heavily, while Wood and I and various other officers wandered about in search of information which no one could give. We now and then came across a brigadier general or even a major general, but nobody knew anything. Some regiments got aboard the trains and some did not, but as none of the trains started, this made little difference. At 3 o'clock, we received orders to march over to an entirely different track, and away we went. No train appeared on this track either, but at 6 o'clock some coal cars came by, and these we seized. By various arguments, we persuaded the engineer in charge of the train to back us down the 9 miles to Port Tampa, where we arrived covered with coal dust, but with all our belongings. The railway tracks ran out on the quay, and the transports, which had been anchored in midstream, were gradually being brought up alongside the quay and loaded. The trains were unloading wherever they happened to be, no attention whatever being paid to the possible position of the transport on which the soldiers were to go. Colonel Wood and I jumped off and started on a hunt, which soon convinced us that we had our work cut out if we were to get our transport at all. From the highest general down, nobody could tell us where to go to find out what transport we were to have. At last, we were informed that we were to hunt up the depot quartermaster, Colonel Humphrey. We found his office, where his assistant informed us that he didn't know where the colonel was, but believed him to be asleep upon one of the transports. This seemed odd at such a time, but so many of the methods in vogue were odd that we were quite prepared to accept it as a fact. However, it proved not to be such, but for an hour Colonel Humphrey might just as well have been asleep, as nobody knew where he was and nobody could find him, and the quay was crammed with some 10,000 men, most of whom were working at cross purposes. At last, however, after over an hour's industrious and rapid search through this swarming ant-heap of humanity, Wood and I, who had separated, found Colonel Humphrey at nearly the same time and were allotted a transport, the Yucatan. She was out in midstream, so Wood seized a stray launch and boarded her. At the same time, I happened to find out that she previously had been allotted to two other regiments, the 2nd Regular Infantry and the 71st New York Volunteers, which latter regiment alone contained more men than could be put on board her. Accordingly, I ran at full speed to our train, and leaving a strong guard with the baggage, I double-quicked the rest of the regiment up to the boat, just in time to board her as she came into the quay, and then to hold her against the 2nd Regulars and the 71st, who had arrived a little too late, being a shade less ready than we were in the matter of individual initiative. There was a good deal of expostulation, but we had possession, and as the ship could not contain half of the men who had been told to go aboard her, the 71st went away, as did all but four companies of the 2nd. These latter we took aboard. Meanwhile, a general had caused our train to be unloaded at the end of the quay farthest from where the ship was, and the hungry, tired men spent most of the day in the labor of bringing down their baggage and the food and ammunition. The officers' horses were on another boat, my own being accompanied by my colonel body servant, Marshall, the most faithful and loyal of men, himself a soldier of the 9th Cavalry. Marshall had been in Indian campaigns, and he christened my larger horse Rain in the Face, while the other, a pony, went by the name of Texas. By the time that night fell, and our transport pulled off and anchored in midstream, we felt we had spent 36 tolerably active hours. The transport was overloaded, the men being packed like sardines, not only below but upon the decks, so that at night it was only possible to walk about by continually stepping over the bodies of the sleepers. The travel rations which had been issued to the men for the voyage were not sufficient, because the meat was very bad indeed, and when a ration consists of only 4 or 5 items, which taken together just meet the requirements of a strong and healthy man, the loss of one item is a serious thing. If we had been given canned corned beef, we would have been all right, but instead of this, the soldiers were issued horrible stuff called canned fresh beef. There was no salt in it. At best, it was stringy and tasteless. At the worst, it was nauseating. Not 1/4 of it was ever eaten at all, even when the men became very hungry. There were no facilities for the men to cook anything. There was no ice for them. The water was not good, and they had no fresh meat or fresh vegetables. However, all these things seemed of small importance compared with the fact that we were really embarked, and were with the first expedition to leave our shores. But by next morning came the news that the order to sail had been countermanded, and that we were to stay where we were for the time being. What this meant, none of us could understand. It turned out later to be due to the blunder of a naval officer who mistook some of our vessels for Spaniards, and by his report caused consternation in Washington until, by vigorous scouting on the part of our other ships, the illusion was dispelled. Meanwhile, the troop ships, packed tight with their living freight, sweltered in the burning heat of Tampa Harbor. There was nothing whatever for the men to do, space being too cramped for amusement or for more drill than was implied in the manual of arms. In this, we drilled them assiduously, and we also continued to hold school for both the officers and the non-commissioned officers. Each troop commander was regarded as responsible for his own non-commissioned officers, and Wood or myself simply dropped in to superintend, just as we did with the manual of arms. In the officers' school, Captain Capron was the special instructor, and a most admirable one he was. The heat, the steaming discomfort, and the confinement, together with the forced inaction, were very irksome, but everyone made the best of it, and there was little or no grumbling even among the men. All, from the highest to the lowest, were bent upon perfecting themselves according to their slender opportunities. Every book of tactics in the regiment was in use from morning until night, and the officers and non-commissioned officers were always studying the problems presented at the schools. About the only amusement was bathing over the side, in which we indulged, both in the morning and evening. Many of the men from the far west had never seen the ocean. One of them, who knew how to swim, was much interested in finding that the ocean water was not drinkable. Another, who had never in his life before seen any water more extensive than the headstream of the Rio Grande, met with an accident later in the voyage. That is, his hat blew away while we were in mid-ocean, and I heard him explaining the accident to a friend in the following words. Jim, my hat blew into the creek. So we lay for nearly a week, the vessels swinging around on their anchor chains, while the hot water of the bay flowed to and fro around them and the sun burned overhead. At last, on the evening of June 13th, we received the welcome order to start. Ship after ship weighed anchor and went slowly ahead under half steam for the distant mouth of the harbor, the bands playing, the flags flying, the rigging black, with the clustered soldiers cheering and shouting to those left behind on the quay and to their fellows on the other ships. The channel was very tortuous, and we anchored before we had gone far down it, after coming within an ace of a bad collision with another transport. The next morning we were all again under way, and in the afternoon the great fleet steamed southeast until Tampa Light sank in the distance. The End. Read by Leonidas for Lit2Go on the web at fcit.usf.edu.